to get a sense?
Chaf Dalam Yubez, okay.
Anyone any farther than that? Not that I'm saying anyone should be. Alright, take a second to get to the right half here. Alright, so we had been, if I remember correctly, on Chaf Beis Amud Aleph at the bottom. And let's try to discuss this one major theme today, just to get into it. So just to get from the Gemara where we left off, the Gemara is talking about a lot of themes in the beginning of this parak that have to do with retroactive approval, basically. And the idea that one can be okay with something after the fact, and that's how we get into the whole discussion from Yeyesh Shalom Midas, and if there is Yeyesh at a later point, or if there is an assumed Yeyesh, can that be effective to create Yeyesh even before it's known to the owner? So in the context of that, the Gemara invokes a lot of other examples of retroactive approval, so to speak, which is interesting in general because it helps give us a little bit of a insight into what Yeyesh may be about. We mentioned when we talked broadly about Yeyesh that there are some who understand Yeyesh as a kind of a nichusa, as kind of a lack of objection, so to speak. So it's interesting to see the cases that the Gemara compares it to, the different areas in Halacha where that's a relevant term. So we had discussed last week the Gemara's reference in cases about taking truma on somebody else's behalf, and if the owner comes out and doesn't seem to object, and the Gemara went from there to cases where people are simply taking food that belongs to a third party, it's presented by somebody who's not the owner, and the question of can they assume that they have permission to take the food, and if the owner comes in later and makes it clear that he's okay with it, does that mean retroactively it was okay to take it? Do we have to worry that the owner might not be sincere? Which itself is a topic, by the way, we didn't get into that so much, the whole question of avak gezel. That's a Gemara in Maseches Sota, comes up elsewhere. The idea that we have to be careful that when we create social pressure on someone to give us, let's say, usually it's food that's relevant. So when we create social pressure, so that is a form of gezel. It's not the actual gezel, but it's not actually straight up either. The comparison would seem to be that what does gezel normally mean? You know, kneva means I take something without your permission. Gezel would mean I essentially take it from you with your permission. Right? It's just that I give you an unacceptable choice. I put a gun to your head and I say, your money or your life. So in the contrast to the comedian who said, hold on, I'm thinking, or the other comedian who said, I'll give you my life because I need my money for my old age, it's just not a real choice. I know that nobody's going to decide that they rather hold on to their money than their life. So, yes, they're giving it to you of their own free will, so to speak. But essentially, they have no real option. So, when you create social pressure, it's not the same thing. They theoretically could overcome it. But the idea is that really they don't want to give you the food. But they're going to be embarrassed if they look stingy, if they look like they're not complying with good manners. So therefore, they feel essentially they have no choice. You ask somebody, somebody's about to eat lunch, take a question in a second, somebody's about to eat lunch, and you say, by the way, can I have half your lunch? So he doesn't really want to give you half his lunch, but he feels now that the pressure is put on him to provide the food to you, or he's going to look stingy. So you could see where it falls into a comparison to gezel somewhere, even though theoretically there's more free will invoked here than the case where it's literally do or die, but it's somewhere in the parsha of something similar to gezel, and that's related to our Gemara's. You know, our Gemara, which is saying here, that maybe we can't rely on the fact that the person said it's okay because of ksifusa, that maybe he's just saying it because he's embarrassed. So that's a very relevant concern, lahalacha, that we have to wonder if the approval is really genuine. So that was related to Gemara's that we saw last week, and now the Gemara is going to bring in a completely different context where approval is also relevant. Sorry, Michael, you had your hand.
Is a prenuptial agreement possibly an issue of mavak gezel?
Mavak gezel, presumably not. The question that's discussed within the background of that is a question whether it's asmachta, which is a similar concept, it definitely has overlapping themes, the question of somebody commits himself to pay money, and the assumption is that he never really thinks it's going to come up. Somebody says that I'll pay you $1 million if I don't show up on time. So then, presumably, he's trying to say, I'm sure I'm going to show up on time, and I'm giving you this number because I'm trying to make the point that it's definitely going to happen. So then, if it doesn't happen, so theoretically, you say, okay, he owes you $1 million. But the whole context seems to suggest that it wasn't a sincere commitment, which is also the major issue when it comes to gambling, right? That the problem is, if some of the reason the Mishnah says that a gambler is possible to aid this, one of the two reasons is because we're afraid that it's not a genuine kinyan. The person who has to pay up the debt, the loser, who has to pay to the winner, so the loser doesn't really want to be giving the money, he just committed it because he thought he was going to win, and now he ends up losing, so the winner is, so to speak, almost stealing the money. So that's a concern of asmachta in general. So the issue is raised in the context of the prenups, and there are a number of ways to deal with it. It's always a question of the degree. It's also a question of, asmachta could work with a bezdin chashuv. There are ways to make kinyan asmachta in advance. There are ways to address it, and it's a well-trod ground when it comes to the whole prenuptial. So that's very similar concept, the issue of asmachta to this avakazal concept has a lot of overlapping svaras to it, but it's one of the issues that's brought up and that's dealt with in that context. Maybe someday we'll deal with it head-on in a little more detail, but that's one of the issues I think Michelle is up first now.
Maybe said something like when someone makes a business, like they make an offer that they don't expect to happen, or something along those lines with business. How does that work with a ketubah? Because you don't expect to get divorced and have to pay that.
Correct, but that's also formulated in the contract in a way that was a takanas chachamim. So the same way a bezdin chashuv can override asmachta, there are certain things that are absolute policies, which even though you don't necessarily expect it to happen, but it's built in as a requirement, and then it's certainly obligatory.
It's like an exception to the rule.
Well, it works within the process of the rule. It works against
right.
A similar. So too, there are ways, we do have contingency requirements. There are things where people don't expect it to happen, and yet, if it happens, you do have to pay up. So we have to have a way for that to work too. But there are some things where it's considered to be more extreme, and we assume the person really doesn't expect it. And that's where you have to figure out when it's appropriate and when it's not. So it's an overlapping concept, Michael. It does have a lot of connected ideas. But here the case is not so much about anything projected into the future. So right now, if he says, you can have my food, maybe he doesn't really mean it. He's just saying it because he's embarrassed to say anything else, and therefore you have to worry that there is a gezel component. So there's a Gemara in Sota that talks about that, but it's also what's being discussed here, this Sifusa idea, the idea that there is embarrassment involved. So you have to worry if it's a real kinyan. There's a whole discussion, there's a Gemara in Kedushin as well, we alluded to it last week, about whether or not you then have any real right to what's being given to you. It could be you're essentially stealing it, and then the question is, somebody wanted to make a Kadesh and Isha with something like that, does he actually have ownership in order for the Kedushin to be Chal? It's a serious question brought up by a Gemara and a whole discussion later. Aaron?
You say that's Machalokan. Would you be allowed to, if you lose, pay the winner still, in a way which you can do him as Matana? Would that be Mutter?
Well, so the question is still, why are you doing that? It all comes back to the same thing. You're doing
but
it.
But I mean, even if logically goes as machlokani, so you don't have to pay him, but would it be usher to give it to him still as a machana?
Presumably, it's not usher. The question is, the recipient has the usher. The recipient may still have to be concerned that he's not getting it out of any genuine basis. He didn't pay anything for it. He didn't sell anything to this person. He didn't damage this person's property. Or he didn't have his property damaged by this guy, rather. There's nothing he did to earn this money, so why is he taking it? So it all comes back to the same thing. The guy is giving it to him because he feels socially obligated to, because his friends are going to make fun of him if he doesn't pay up his gambling debts, or they're going to break his kneecaps, whatever context he's living in. But in any event, he doesn't have a genuine recognized debt to this guy, and that's where we get into a problem. But it's really a different concept, but it has some overlapping ideas here. So just to make some progress in the Gemara, and then we have a whole other meta theme we want to get to, is that the Gemara brings up a very different issue of nichusa. It has to do with hechsher tuma, that if your fruit has a moisture on it, and the moisture was with the consent, or the intent or the consent, of the owner, so then that makes it susceptible to Kabbalah's Tumah. So here the Gemara discusses that in this context, in terms of retroactive approval. So the last line of the Gemara here in Chav Beis Amud Aleph, Odehu Atal Alehem, that if you have this fruit that still has dew on it, so it has moisture on it, and the owner sees this, V'samach Harei Zeh B'Chiyuton. So then that is considered to be what the Torah describes of Kiyuton, that water has been placed upon it with the approval of the owner, and therefore it is susceptible to Tumah. So that's assuming that it's still wet at the time. Nagvo afal pisha samach, if it already got dried off, even if the Bailim is happy, was happy with the fact that it was moist, so einan b'chuyuton, it's not considered to be in this category of susceptibility to tumah. Taima mai, lav mishum delo amrinan, kevan digloi milsuk. The hashtanichale meikar namanichale. So apparently we're not willing to say that just because we know that retroactively he would have been happy, so we can translate that to now. We're not able to retroactively impose his happiness on the situation and consider it within his consent. So says the Gemara, no, this is an exception. It's because of the pasuk. Shiny hasam, dechsiv ki yutan, but it's spelled ki yitain, as if that's what it says, as if he is going to put it, ad she yitain. He has to do it himself. Well, hold on a second, that's not what the first part has. So the first part that says it works, if it's still wet when he sees it, so yachi reishanami. So then the first one's not going to work either, because in neither situation did he actually put the moisture on it. So hasam ki the Rav Papa. This is in accordance with Rav Papa. The Rav Papa Rami, Papa raised the question, ksiv ki yitain, vikarinan ki yutan. But the letters say as if he would put it on, and we read it as ki yutan. So ha ketzad, how should we understand that? Bo'inan ki yutan dumya de ki yitain. That even though we're talking about the water passively being on there, not that he necessarily actually put it on there himself, but it has to be comparable to a situation in which he would have put it there himself. Ma yitain ladas af ki yutan nami ladas. So just as if he put it there, he's doing it knowingly. So too, if it was placed there, it could also work as long as it's comparable in the sense that he knew about it as well. So he has to have approval of the situation while it's actually there. And if that's the case, if he has the approval while it's there, so then that's comparable to him putting it himself, and that's good. But if it's after the fact that the moisture is no longer there, so the fact that he would have been happy at the time, we see that from the fact he's happy now, doesn't help. That's not retroactively effective, but it's not necessarily relevant to our situation because there's a separate din. It's a pasuk that tells us how this is supposed to work. And maybe it's not a concept that we could translate to Aveda. But the Havamin is still fascinating, right? Because again, we're trying to figure out what Yeish means and whether Yeish is something that the owner has to actually do or whether it's a lack of objection or the like. So the comparison to other areas of Halacha where we just need consent, passive consent, after the fact consent, and what areas are relevant, what areas aren't relevant, is a fascinating type of approach. This is a sugya that the Avinezer would have been very into. You know, the whole approach, the Avinezer was famous for his approach in learning, which his Talmidim also picked up on. Rav Schechter often comments about the Avinezer being particularly adept at it, the ability to see a concept in the Talmud for its real inner structure, its inner core, that the lumdus and the concept that separate from any application, and to figure out how you could say that a Gemara in Zvachim and a Gemara in Bav Metzia are talking about the same thing, even though they're addressing completely different areas of halacha because they have comparable mechanisms. So these Gemaras are very much in his style. You know, this idea of talking about a Gemara about Hekshar Tumah and comparing it to a Gemara about Yeish, and comparing that to a Gemara about Hefreshes Truma, all completely different areas in halacha, and all they have in common is retroactive approval of something. So it's a very longish figure. And it's very much a Sachachav respect. Okay, so the Gemara goes on to talk about something which seems to be something we had before, or seems to connect to something we had before. And this is a major issue, which we'll spend a few minutes on now. Says the Gemara, Tashma, the Amr Rabbi Yochanan, Bishim Rabbi Yishmael, Ben Yod Zadok, Minayim Aveda Sheshotva Nar, Shehimu Teres. How do you know if you have an Aveda that was essentially drowned, was essentially completely overtaken by a river, by a flood, Shehimu Teres, that it's permissible? Dechsiv, V'chein Tasa L'chamoro, V'chein Tasa L'simlasu, V'chein Tasa L'chol Aveda Sachicha Asher Tova Mimanu Motsasa. So that's the whole pasuk in Kiseitze that we mentioned at the very beginning. So what's the common element, or what's mentioned in this pasuk? Mishavude heimanu mitzuya etzel kol adam. The whole idea of a mitzia that has to be returned, an aved and a mitzia, is that it's disconnected from the owner, but other people can find it. That it's just separated from its owner, but it's not essentially obliterated from any connection to anybody. So that excludes the situation where it's not only separated from its owner, but it's also separated from humanity as a whole. Now this is a vague concept, because clearly it's not actually separated from humanity as a whole, because someone found it. Right? So we have to figure out that some subjectivity here, and in order to give us a little more clarity with this, it brought in some discussions in postgame about actual real cases, and we'll spend a few minutes talking about, because the concept is a hard concept to understand. What do we mean that it's lost from all of humanity? It's clearly not lost from all of humanity if it's found by somebody. So we have to figure out where to draw the line, but apparently there's some level where it's different than a normal Aveda, where it simply fell out of your pocket and everyone else can pick it up. But there's some traumatic event. There was a flood, there was a tornado, everything was so, I guess it's very appropriate for this past week's parsha, but there was a redefinition of everything. There was a flood that came in and nothing is the same anymore, everything has been wiped out. So there's no connection anymore between this and anybody. And somehow eventually it gets found again by somebody else. So that is apparently also considered to be permissible for the owner. For the finder, rather. The finder is allowed to keep it. So the Surah Dumya de Hatera, says the Gemara, so Ma Hatera bein the Isbe Simim and the Lasbe Simim. So here we will compare the Surah and Hatera. So what we mean is here, in this situation, where we're letting you keep it, so here, this is a new din, it doesn't matter whether it's a Simim or not. Right? The whole relevance of a Simim till now, we're trying to figure out if there's automatic Yeish. Because the lack of a simon would be in Yeish. But here in this case, where it's wiped out from all humanity, so we don't care if there's a simon. So the suggestion here is, let's say the lack of focus on simon is relevant in both directions. But in that situation where you're allowed to keep it because avud mikol adam, so we don't care whether there's a simon or not. So too in terms of returning it, so also we don't care whether there's a simon. You have to return it either way, if you take it without the head to. So Ma Teira Bein De'Esbe Simen De'Lesbe Simen Shara Afisura Bein De'Esbe Simen Bein De'Lesbe Simen Asura Chuvta D'Rava Tiyuvta. Okay, so Rav has been refuted. We don't say Yeish Shalom Midas is Yeish. Rather, we pass him like Abaye. Yeish Shalom Midas is not considered to be Yeish. So, there's a whole other din that's going to come up. So let's spend a few minutes talking about some very important concepts that are relevant to this entire parak, and maybe really relevant to this entire mesechta, maybe really relevant to our entire lives. So let's spend a few minutes talking about some important ideas. So first of all, this halacha of shatfa nar seems to be the same halacha of zutul shalyam. Right? That essentially there is a context where something is completely negated from being found. And then, once it's found later, it's got to be as if it was reborn. It's just found in a completely different context. So, does that have any relationship to Yeish? So, it seems like that was the Machlokus Rishonim. That, if you look at Tosfos over here, Tosfos Isura, and the Ritva as well, says something along these lines, that this is a special Gzeres HaKasuv. This pasuk that's quoted is a special Gzeres HaKasuv. And that's not because of Yeish. Here you see the Tosfos here on the top of the page.
Mashamater avuda mimenu mikol adam akarchalo itzurich kra biyada misyayish.
that feel mitzvahs are called the mataris b'yayish. It's not a context where there's yayish, that we would be no without the pasuk, and that we wouldn't need this requirement of avuta mikol adon. Elo istrich elo kilo yada v'yachal gav d'luchi yada lo misyayish. Afilu amyesh posim and kevin she avuta mikol adon. So this din of avuta mikol adon is a separate concept which applies even if there's a simon, and is not connected to Yayish. And even if you could say the person would not be Yayish, the halacha still applies. This is a new category. And the Ritva says like that as well. There are other Rishonim, however, who say a little bit differently. Rav Vosner has a tshuva here in Chelek Yud, where he reads Rashi as saying this is a din in Yayish. I think the diak is a little bit harder in Rashi. It's in Chafala from the Beis. That the Rashi is on Chafalas Mibay's Rachmana Sharye. So Rashi there says, V'afilu basli de hamotzi lifnei yeish. So Rav Vosner understands that Rashi to mean that yeish is a factor, but just this is working off yeish without needing yeish. And it's basically such an absolute devastation that assumes yeish even if the owner hadn't yet been miyayish. I'm not sure if Rashi has to be read that way, but Rabbeinu Chananel is a little bit more explicit. If you look at Rabbeinu Chananel on the bottom of that page, in Chafala from the Beis, so Rabbeinu Chananel, talking about this, has the language that the Ha Vadai Nisyayishin. So it seems that at least Rabbeinu Chananel, maybe Rashi, reads this as a function of a essential universal Yayish, and even if the person would actually maybe object, but still it's just an assumed Yayish. And the other Rishonim see it as not relying on Yayish, that even if the person's not Miyayish, this is a different thing. Yayish is one reason you're allowed to keep it, and Avudu Mena Michal Adam is another reason you're allowed to keep it. Hi.
One of the things everyone said is that even if we knew that he was specifically Miyayish, it's possible that the Umdina would still be greater than that, if I understand correctly?
Well, but we wouldn't need it. If you know that he was not Miyayish or something?
No, if we knew that he was specifically.
If he was, then
no,
we
would... If in the case where it's swept away by the river, we assume that even if there's a sim, then you give up hope.
Yes, so that's... Well, but we assume that it's mutter. The question is, do we assume that it's mutter because we give up hope, or for other reasons? The Gemara says it's mutter. Right? The Gemara says the finder is allowed to keep it. The question is that because of Yayish? Or is it even without Yayish? And maybe even if we knew the guy would not be Yayish. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't require Yayish. Maybe... Maybe the disconnect between this and in a normal Aved, you need Yayish, disconnected from the owner. But here, it's so absolute, it's been knocked, the whole world has been reshuffled thanks to Noach and his flood, that there's no connection anymore to the finder, even to the loser, even if he would not be Miyayish person. It's just a whole new Madrega. It's got its own Pasuk, it's its own Din. That's how Tostus and the Ritva seem to understand, it's not looking to Yayish. Hi.
Even when you look at those cases, it comes just right after the Gemara is talking about all the Yayish cases, like it fits right in.
Yeah, it certainly has a common, certainly part of the same section of halacha. I mean, you know, it certainly has a lot in common with it, but it doesn't. I don't know if that's dispositive because it works either way. If it's about Yayish, then for sure it fits. But even if it's not about Yayish, it's certainly about different reasons why the finder can keep it. So it certainly belongs here. It's not. It's not going to be jarring in the way you look at it. Now, there is a discussion we mentioned in the context of Yayish, and we talked about that at the beginning of the parak, that many achronim, such as the Nesivis, assume that, we talked about how Yayish works, whether it's a hefker or whether it's something else, but that many assume that it doesn't take effect until the finder actually is zocha to it. If the finder, if somebody finds it, so then it becomes his, but if the owner is unmiyayish before the finder finds it, then it goes back to him. It's not, it doesn't take effect until it actually transfers into somebody else's property. And Rav Nosson Gestetner in a tshuva that we'll talk about in a second, and the Horus Nosson over here in Chelek Zion, so he assumes that's the case here also, that whether it's yayish or whether it's a different din, that it doesn't actually leave the owner's possession until someone else is zochebo. And this is an opportunity to talk about a very important concept in Eilu Metzias, which is a very important concept in Bav Metzia, which is a very important concept in Kol HaTorah Kula, and in our major Avodas HaChaim. So it is generally assumed that both in terms of after Yeish, which I'm sure this is a question on many people's minds, but also in terms of this din of Avudah Mimena Mikolada, that even though one is allowed to keep it, nonetheless, it's proper to return it. And that's what is brought in Shulchan Aruch and the Rambah, that in Reishon and Tes, where these in Choshen Mishpat, where these dinim are found. So the Rambah has a comment that Mishum Vasisa Yashar V'Hatov, it's right to return the property. So if a person should show up and you know that it's clearly his, presumably you're not mechuyev to look for him under these contexts. You know, there's no chiyuv hashav v'saveda, but the guy shows up and he has a compelling case that it's his, and you know that it really is his, so then it's still proper to give it back. And the Shach quotes from the Aguda that is the minig nowadays, that we do return property. He's talking about that din over there of matzal mizuto shalyam shat fanar. And it seems to be the assumption also in the context of post-Yeish that that's the case as well, that we generally either recommend that you give it back. Some discuss maybe we should be kofa. And what's also invoked is the question of if the finder is a ashir and the loser is an ani, then all the more so we say that it's proper to give it back. And the Be'er Heitev quotes a view that the only time we don't say it's proper to give it back is if it's tarta l'malusa. He has 2 points in his favor, that if the loser is an ashir and the finder is an ani, so then okay, we won't pressure him to give it back. But other than that, we would pressure him to give it back. So this is a fascinating concept in general. The whole idea of Asisa Yashar V'Hatov and Lefnim Meshura Sadin is a crucial concept and a very difficult concept.
It's only by an Aveda of a Jew, right? Because there's no necessary Yashar V'Hatov by non-Jews.
I don't know if there's any reason to say that. We find certain other chilukim in terms of Hashavas Aveda, and that's also a meta topic that maybe we'll come to once the Gemara brings it up. But I don't know if that has any connection to Asisa Yashar V'Hatov at all. It has relevance within Hilchos Mesiyah Veveda. Maybe again we'll get to that when we
come. Is that localized by Jews, or?
I don't see a reason to say that, and it's maybe a reason, a big reason to say the opposite.
Meaning, if there's no aspect of Chil Hashem, or
yeah, even without that, I don't think that it's necessarily tied into that for a lot of reasons. We'll try to discuss now for a few minutes what Asisa Yashar V'Hatov could mean for us, but there's a lot of reasons why it wouldn't necessarily be tied to that. I think it was simple as a first, and then Jonathan.
That's just what I was being selling, it's like a Mimba Sharsadin kind of thing, that like it's a suggestion, but Asisa Yashar V'Hatov sounds like it's evil, like.
Correct.
You have
so
to do that. You have, even if it's not.
So this was a big machlokas Rishonim. And there's a very famous article in English by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Shalita about the question of ethic outside of halacha, where he talks about that machlokas. And you have to figure out what the concept means, because Asisa V'Yashar V'Hatov is a clear mitzvah in the Torah, and the Ramban has a famous comment. It's a little bit less famous than his more famous comment. It's very similar to a more famous comment he has. Parshas Kedoshim is a very famous comment where he says, why does the Torah tell us Kedoshim to you? Right, well, so the Ramban says this comment in both places. The Kedoshim to you is more well known. But in that context, he says that why does the Torah have to tell us to be holy? We know that we should be holy. That's the whole point of the rest of the Torah. So A, we know it, and B, it's kind of vague. What does it mean to say be holy? So the Ramban says that the whole purpose of the Torah is to create a holy personality. And it's possible that you could miss the whole picture, that you could feel that you could keep all the details and somehow still be what he calls a naval versus a Torah. And that would be a bad thing. So that's no longer possible, because the Torah says Kedoshim to you. So you're not Bereshus HaTorah. You can't be a disgusting person while still adhering to the actual mitzvahs of the Torah. So the Ramban has a very similar comment in the pasuk of Asisa Hayashar V'Hatov, where the same questions could be asked. It's both apparently a little bit redundant and a little bit vague. What does it mean? And what does it add to all the other mitzvahs of the Torah that tell us about how we should treat each other? And there he suggests also that it's possible for one to stick to all the details of an adam l'chavero and still be what's known in halachic terms as a jerk. So therefore the Torah tells us that you should not be a jerk, but rather, as you say, Yashar V'Hatov, you have to see the pattern of what it means to be a good person. He talks there about lifnim mishur sadin, which is also sometimes invoked in the Gemara as something akin to a chiyuv, and some of the Rishonim actually do count it as a chiyuv. So it's a very difficult question to understand, because if by its very definition lifnim mishur sadin means above the letter of the law, so
a chiyuv that every time it comes up you're required to go with that, or that generally speaking you should try.
So it's a fair question, and I'm not sure if there's one answer to that question, but we have to figure out first what does the terminology mean. How could it mean both beyond the law and be the law? And if that was so desirable, then why is that not the law? You know, why don't we make that the Iker HaDin then? What's the point in having a din that by its very nature falls short of what we want you to do? So there are a couple approaches one could take, if especially if one says that this is the din, so then you have to really answer the question. Even if you don't say it's the din, we still have to figure out that if the Torah thinks this is a desirable behavior, why was it not made the chiyuv? But especially if you say, like some of Rishon, the Rav, the Rabban, that this is actual chiyuv, so then you really have to answer the question of, so what's the difference between the din and lefnim mishur hasadin? So one way to say it, which is particularly relevant, I think, in this context also, is that there are ways that we clearly perceive as exalted behavior, but it's not simply not possible to obligate everyone to do that all the time. So we can convey the message that we think this is what is praiseworthy, and this is the way we expect a Ben Torah to behave, but it's not feasible to make it the letter of the law for all of humanity at all times. So we can have a dual system in a sense where we say, okay, this is going to be the letter of the law, but we can also convey the message that there is a higher standard that is encouraged when it's possible. Particularly in the context of Metzia and Aveda and the like, so one can also say that there are certain interpersonal questions where there's going to be an internal struggle between Reuven and Shimon who gets it. And we have to draw the line somewhere. So we have to have an objective din for who's going to win in certain scenarios. But there's still going to be real life situations where there's clear objective reasons to have sympathy for the person who's on the other side. So to give that particularly in terms of our parak, Metzias V'Aveda, so we know that if somebody has access to his property, so it's his. If somebody loses the property and he's not looking for it anymore, and we can't get back to him, doesn't have a simon, so then at some point there's no value to society to let this object munach ad shiyavo aliyo. It's not a part of one of those dinim where we have that policy. So why should this item be unused to humanity forever? So eventually we have to draw the line when it's mutter. And we can't have that be permanently reversible. It can't be that the halacha says that you can find something and keep it, but you have to always worry, look over your shoulder, that somebody is going to come and say it's theirs. So we have to be able to have an objective system where it transfers from being returnable to being non-returnable. You know, the modern day example, which we find both in halachic systems and non-halachic systems, where a lost and found will say, you know, after 30 days it becomes the property of the institution or whatever, becomes hefker. So those seem like arbitrary numbers, and you see that both in halachic institutions and non-halachic institutions. The point is that we recognize that we have to draw the line somewhere where, okay, we believe it's reasonable for this to be returned, and we believe that it's not so reasonable, and therefore it's fair for whoever finds it to keep it. Now, we have to therefore have objective rules. So we have these rules, okay, so yeyesh, avud, menim, mekoladim, it becomes fair game. But if real life is that the person nonetheless, despite the expectations, does turn up, and he's a sympathetic figure, you know, and it's he's worse off than the person who found it, so then it clearly becomes right to have rahmanis on this person and to return it to them. And to recognize that you didn't actually pay for this. You know, that if this is something you paid for, so then it becomes much more complicated. But if this is something that was a windfall for you, and it's a real loss to the other person, so in general, It's not where there was an actual transaction here. So it's right to have sympathy for this person. That's something we can relate to. And therefore, the Asisa of Hayashav HaTov kicks in. Jonathan,
I don't know if there's any nafkaminas, but at that point, then, do we say that you're being kind of mitzvah of Shabbos Aveda?
So it sounds like, no, it's a different mitzvah. It sounds like that's the Asisa of Hayashav HaTov. The Shabbos Aveda has its own set of rules, and that's probably a different thing. Hi.
Yeah, thank you.
I was about to bring that up. That's a good segue also, because that also helps us to paint the picture a little bit. That the Dina de Bar Metzra, which Jonathan Teitelbaum is referring to, is that, so let's say I have land to sell. So I could sell it to anyone in the world. I have the right to sell land to anybody I want to. But it happens to be that there's somebody else who has land next to it. And therefore, this land is much more valuable to him than it is to anyone else, because he can make more use of it by combining it with his existing land. So it's right for me to, the Gemara says, that it's nice of me, it's appropriate of me to offer it to him first. And there, that's similar to the Shabbos Aveda thing, because if you're just focusing on the Ani and the Usher, so you could say, all right, so it's Staka now. So it's Staka, let me give it to any poor person. Instead of giving it back to the guy who lost it, let me find somebody who's even poorer than him and give it to him. Or let me find some Ani Yircha, somebody who's on a higher rung in the priority of Staka. So it's somewhat Staka related, but it's more than that, the person who has a connection, a pre-existing emotional or investment in this property, so he's the appropriate choice. He should get it back more than any stam money. So it's not a normal staka where you're going to follow the rules of kedimas and staka, but it has it's closer to bar mitzvah, where you find the mishursa and invoked that this loser, I don't mean that in the pejorative terms, the guy who actually lost the property, is the bar mitzvah of this item, so to speak. And that's a situation where you would say Lefnei Mishura Sadin. I'm not asking a question about that.
Didn't a Debar Matzer though, a few on the buyer, that the buyer has to make sure that the neighbor has a shot at it first?
Well, it's really the seller has the one who has the control for selling to the.
I mean, he has control who he's selling it to, but he doesn't have to sell it for less money too.
So the question of less money gets into some of the complicated details, just in terms of giving the opportunity to the person who's closer to it, and that's on the seller, because of the thing Shor said there.
Let's say the seller sells it to someone and he doesn't offer it to the bar mitzvah. So who's over?
Presumably the seller.
The buyer's not over for.
We have to look at the sugya in a little more detail, but for our purposes now, we can assume it's the seller. So, yes, Michael.
Is Lefnim Shor synonymous with Chomra?
No. Chumra opens up all kinds of other, it could overlap also, but it has all kinds of other connotations and usages. But especially if not, if the Fnimashur is Adin, it is the Menadin, when we say it's the Chiyuv. So we're trying to figure out again why it would be that you could have both at the same time, that the letter of the law would be one thing, and at the same time the halacha would either encourage or possibly obligate you to do something different. So one context is what we just said, that we need to have some type of kind of objective rule, but life could present itself a little bit differently, and we'll come back to that in a second. But another major area would be is if the letter of the law allows you to act one way, but it has a corrosive effect on your character, that if this allows you to profit without putting in any effort, and now there's somebody else who's really going to face a loss at the same time. We could all profit, we could all have a windfall that doesn't have any effort, and it's not necessarily a terrible thing, but especially when you put that together with somebody else who's now going to be losing and somebody who's going to be suffering. So that has a corrosive effect on the character. And if that's the case, you may also find that it would make sense to say, listen, I'll be the halacha between you and him, so you're entitled to keep it. But in terms of the effect this is going to have on your sense of yashrus, and your sense of what is fair and what is straight, so it's not good for you to hold on to this. So we could say, we'll be kofi, you need to act differently, and that's also a context in which you could understand why there would be a distinction. But similar also to the previous point, and that's also why, Menachem, I don't think it's more about you. I don't think it really even make a difference who you're dealing with so much in terms of the effect it's going to have on your character. But also, another variation of what we said before is, and this is something that there are makoros from Shas for, and maybe if you have your Bav Metzias, I'll tell you to look for a second. There's a Gemara on page Gimel Amud Aleph. Which, see how quickly I can switch to that daf on this program. Very important Gemara, which is very uses different psukim, but it's very important to how we think about some of these things. Yeah, the Gemara at the very end of the sixth parak on Pegimel Amud Aleph. So the Gemara tells a story at the very end of the parak. Rabba Bar Bar Chanan, or possibly Rabba Bar Bar Chama, as is corrected on the side. So Tavrele Hanau Shakuloi Chavisa de Chamra. So he had workers who worked for him, and they broke a barrel of wine that belonged to him. So it seems like they were negligent, and that they are liable for this. And Shakul Glimayu. So he was holding on to their clothes as collateral, apparently. So Asu Amru L'Rav, so they came and they complained to Rav. Amrle, so Rav's psak was to Rav Bar Chanan, Havlu Glimayu. You have to return their clothes to them. So he said to him, Amrluhu, Amrle, Dina Hachi, that's the din. The din is I have to give back the clothing to these people who broke my stuff. So Amrle in, he said, yes. You know why it's the din? Laman Kalech B'derech Tova. Because you should be a good person. You should walk on the good path. So even though you're the quote-unquote victim, you had your stuff broken, still you should give back this collateral to the people who broke it. So fine, Yoyev Lo Gomayu. So he gave them back their clothing. They complained again, because so they got back what they would have had to pay, but they're still not getting paid for the day's work. So they're going to go home starving. So Amrule, Aniye Anan, V'tarchinan kuliyoma v'kafina v'leslan midday. So we worked all day, and now we're going home with nothing. So we're not losing our clothes, but we don't have anything to eat. So Amrule, Zil havagrayu. So now Rav says to Rabbi Chanan, pay them their wages. So Amalei Dina Hachi, he said, that's the din, that's the letter of the law that I have to pay these people. So he said, Amalei, and he said, yeah, the Orcho Sadikim Tishmor. You should follow the paths of Sadikim. So again, it's different words, but it's the same idea of Fasisa Yashav Hatov as apparently a Chiyuv, right? He's saying, Dina Hachi, that's the din, I have to do this. And he told, yeah, you have to do this. So it sounds like it's something a little bit more. And again, if it's staka, so would that fit in with the words of Dina Hachid? But we do have an idea of kofen alat staka. But it seems again like it's a little bit more. It has to do with a particular...
Because if they weren't a me and maybe had to pay them.
So no, so that seems to be the point, which is something that is important to clarify. Right, that there is a letter of the law that applies to Ruvain and Shimon. Apparently what can be derived from this Gemara is there is, and this is something again you should say, Kedai read Rav Lichtenstein's famous article, it's really a very often cited article where he talks about this, but the idea seems to be that there's one letter of the law that applies to Reuven and Shimon, again, because we always have to have a letter of the law, but in the circumstance where it's not Reuven and Shimon, it's Mr. Goldberg and Mr. Schwartz, who are real people, and Mr. Goldberg is very wealthy and Mr. Schwartz is going to go home starving, then that can change how things should be. Which now, again, the Torah says that a dayan is not allowed to favor the poor person. In terms of the letter of the law, he has to still say the din is what the din is. But in terms of what he's telling the rich man his moral obligations are, and that's essentially what's happening here, now, Rabbi Bar Chanan is saying, do I really have to do this? As a religious Jew, this, you're telling me this is my obligation. He's saying, yes, it's your obligation to be a good person. And that's what this means. So this seems to come up in the context of these types of situations. And it's very much a theme that affects our entire parak, which tells us that we can keep stuff that somebody else lost after Yeish or after Avudah Menah Mikol Adam. So maybe that's true because, again, we have to draw the line somewhere. But in a situation where it's really going to be a hardship on somebody, and it's not such a hardship on you, at least in those circumstances, so then it's really the right thing to do if the person shows up to give it back to him anyway. So I do have to leave in a second, but I just wanted to discuss a fascinating tshuva that I saw here in the Tshuvas L'Haris Nasan. It's also discussed by Rav Vosner and Shevet Halevi, but it helps to illustrate both these concepts that we're talking about, because we said that the whole concept of Avudim Imanu Mikol Adam is a difficult idea to understand because it's a little bit of a contradiction to it being found by anyone. And the idea also of the Slufnim Mishur Sadin. So a fascinating real life case. Says there was a Sefer Torah that belonged to a certain big tzaddik, and it was lost during the Holocaust. And eventually it was found by someone who knew that it was connected to this famous tzaddik. Maybe this famous tzaddik wrote it. So this person, Reuven, called in the tshuva. So Reuven obtains it. He purchases it for himself after the war is over. And then a relative, some type of descendant of this famous tzaddik, shows up. So Reuven decides to let this relative have it because it's very important to him. And then the relative dies, and the relative had thought that he now owned it and he's passing it on to his heirs. And Reuven is claiming that he never meant to give it to the relative forever. He only let him have it during his lifetime because it made him happy and it gave him comfort. But now that he died, it's really Reuven's, and Reuven wants it back. And he never intended to actually give it to this relative forever. So this is a fascinating tshuva from a couple of angles. So first of all, is it really the property of this relative? You could say that it was always his property because it belonged to his ancestor. The ancestor lost it, so it's a aveda, but it's his. And the inheritor should get it. So the attitude that both Rav Vosner and Rav Gishtetner take is that this is a case of Avuda Mikol Adam, that the Nazis took over and they destroyed everything and they didn't show any respect for anything. So any property that was under that influence has a din, like Zuto Shoyam. In fact, it says, Ein lecha Zuto Shoyam Gadol Mizeh. This is absolute devastation. This is a complete redefining of all property, and anything that was in that context, one could assume it's as if it was swept away by the ocean and is completely gone. So they both take that attitude that this is a case of what our Gemara talks about, of Shot Fanar, Zutl Shayam, this complete obliteration. However, the question becomes, is there a situation of Yasisa Yashuv HaTov? So Rav Gishtetner inclines more towards that direction, that he thinks that there is a Yasisa Yashuv HaTov involved in giving it back to the family. And he gets into the question of Ani and Ashir. So here it's not a monetary issue so much. It is a more of a sentimental issue, or not necessarily sentimental, but it's about its value that's not monetary in nature, but its value because of its importance and its connection to this tzaddik. So you could say that by its very nature, even if the finder was rich, but he doesn't have this chashivas, so therefore he's an Ani as far as that's concerned, but then that makes the loser an Ani also. You can't make him an Ani without making the loser an Ani. And since it's not something that the finder would need to live, it's not valuable in a monetary sense, so it's hard to not put it in that definition, he says. He says, like the Tzos says, the reason that we don't, if we say that it's Vasisa Yashur HaTov, to return it to the owner if he shows up after Yeish, or after Avuda Mikol Adam, so why do we distinguish between an Ani and an Ashir? So we distinguish because the Ani is just not capable of doing Vasisa Yashur HaTov. He's so poor, we can't ask him to go beyond the letter of the law. But here, this is not necessary for his sustenance. This is just something that is nice to have because it's chashivus. So he's no more Ani than the family member, so he thinks it's right to give it back to the family member. So then there's a whole discussion he gets into about the question of whether you can say kofin on Vasisa Yashuv HaTov would compel it. So what does it mean to compel it? So he points out that there are many poskim who say that if it was tafas, if the person who should get it because of Vasisa Yashuv HaTov grabs it, so then we don't take it away from him. Even if we don't necessarily take it away from the mufsak, but we don't take it back from the person who takes it, if also Yashuv HaTov, he should be getting it. So since it happens to be in the hands of the relative right now, because Reuven gave it to him, so that's comparable to Tfisa, And Rav Gishtetner thinks he's inclined to think it should go to the relative. The fact that it's in his hands, it's a question of whether that would have made him a muchzak in this case, because if a Sefer Torah is something that one is in the habit of lending out, so it's not clear how much there was a real chazaka here. That was the way Rav Vosner was inclined to say. It's not really relevant that it's in his hands. But Rav Gishtetner thought it was relevant enough to say that Vasus of Yashav Atov and Tafis Lomafkinamine, that he was inclined on behalf of the relative. In the end, he says, because there's such a question here, he suggests a pshara, but his inclination is in favor of the relative because of this concern. The relative of the original tzaddik, the one who says that he inherited it. But he also gets into fascinating questions of, this is, by the way, if you want to look it up, it's the Chelek Zayin Kuf Chav Zayin in the Laharus Nasim. He gets into the whole question of, and there's a major suffix here, because you have to figure out when the Nazis took hold of it. So that's when it became Avuda. So was the original tzaddik alive or not? Now, if the original tzaddik was alive, so then it's his Aveda. Or if he died before that happened, so then it transferred already to the Yoresh, and that's also a whole part of the discussion, it's a part of the suffix. It's why in the end he ends up suggesting a pshara, because we can't exactly pin down when that happened. He also gets into the fact that the Sefer Torah was found in the possession of a non-Jew who had hid it away. So apparently what happened was that this tzaddik trusted this, say, his non-Jewish neighbor. So was it really Avuda at that point? He thought he had hidden it away. All of this complexity getting into the discussion. So it's a fascinating real-life case, which I think helps to illustrate the two major topics we spoke about today. One just had a similarly paradoxical concept of something Avuda Mikol Adam yet was found. So what does Avuda mean? And also the whole question of Asis of Yashav HaTov is relevant to all of our lives, and to all of them above Metzia, and certainly especially all of this parak, that you should really return something even after Yeish, even after Avuda. Just want to say parenthetically, this is obviously not a topic I want to start now, because it's a huge topic, but the topic of the Elal tickets and the whole question of what should be done by that. So it's interesting that I was discussing it both with Rashef and Rabbi Willig. They both felt that Meikar Adin, there's real problems with it in terms of it possibly being a Gezel and a Kaftos and the like. But there are many who felt, I'm not taking a side one way or another now, I just want to talk about in terms of our sugya, that Me'ikar Hadin, it was mutter to keep the tickets, but that maybe the Asis V'Yashav HaTov, or morally you should give them back. So that may or may not be true, I'm not getting into it right now, but it's not irrelevant to say then if that's the case, if it's not actual Gezela, so then it's not irrelevant that Elal is a corporation and the person who got the tickets could be a struggling person, because that's what we see. The Gemara factors that in when it comes to the Asis HaYashav HaTov. If it's genuine Gezela, so you have no heter to steal from a rich person any more than to steal from a poor person. But if it's not Gezela, and we're talking about Asis HaYashav HaTov, so we see that the Gemara and the Rishonim and the Poskim factor in Aniv Asher, so it's not something that should be ignored in the context of that discussion. It is a part of how we define what the obligation of the Asis HaYashav HaTov is, and that's also something that's just sometimes neglected in the context of that discussion. Okay, I thank you for your indulgence this morning, and God willing, tomorrow.